Hey, I'm Adam. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks, Dale, for asking me to speak. Thanks for the introduction. And thank you all for having me. I've heard a lot about this meeting, and it's nice to finally have a chance to come out here. And, so my sobriety date is May 10th, 2021. So still in my terrible twos at the time there. I loved when Dale told me that the format of this meeting is to express how I found my relationship with God. Because the line I often hear people say when they get up to share is, I'm here to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And then I always think to myself, isn't it what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now? And that is a good long and short of it. And, so I will definitely hope to get to that point, but I do feel it important to talk about where I came from a little bit, because in that same chapter, it talks about how, nobody like the alcoholic with the personal experience can, help relate to someone else and get their trust and attention. And so what I was like is ever since I was a child, I was very, very afraid. And just standing up here now, I always like to thank God for the humility to remind me that fear is still there. But I have been granted a decent power to get the courage to go through those things. And so there's nothing quite like a room full of eyes and a screen full of squares staring at me to remind me of that, where I came from. And, when I was a kid, I was just afraid of everything. It was pretty crippling at times. Like, I didn't want to do anything, go anywhere, be with anyone. I was always afraid that, A, people would look at me, or B, people wouldn't look at me. It was sort of terrible to be in. And early on when I was a kid, this is just one of these funny stories of, I guess you can call it trauma or something, but anyone ever read those Richard Scarry books for kids? Mm-hmm. Busy Town with the worm driving the apple and all that stuff. Well, I'm a middle child, surprise, surprise. My older brother, he was a nice little golden child. And there's two characters in those stories called, they're brothers. They're kind of like a Goofus and Gallant type of situation. Like, who's the good one and who's the not so good one? My brother was the brother Pig Will. So it's like, well, Pig Will brush his teeth? He will brush his teeth. And then there was Adam, Pig Won't. It's like, Adam, you want to go to the zoo? Like, something fun. It's like, no, I don't want to go to the zoo. Pig won't go to the zoo. And so I was Pig Won't from a very early age. And it just got worse from there. It did not get better. And I had my first midlife crisis when I was like 5 years old. My grandfather died. And I like put two and two together as to like what death was. I was like, oh man, that's going to happen to me one day. And I was like screaming, throwing a fit in my bedroom, like kicking the walls, crying. My parents came in. They're like, Adam, what's wrong? Like, did you break a bone? Did you get stung by a bee? Like, what the hell's going on? Or so, excuse my language. I'll try and watch that. But not always the best then. And I just screamed through my tears. I don't want to die. And I cannot imagine what it's like to have a parent hear their five-year-old in a fit of terror. They just said, you don't have to worry about that right now. But anyways, my anxiety just grew from there. And it grew and grew. Teenage years, add hormones to that. Just got worse and worse. I was a late starter when I found alcohol. I was 18. It was the summer before I went up to college. I had to be dragged through school, like kicking and screaming. I didn't do hardly any work. I passed on basically test scores alone, would sleep through class, but whatever reason, made it with enough to get into a school. And so 18, the summer before college, me and a friend were watching our neighbor's, our best friend's house while their family was on vacation. He had a buddy with a fake. And got a case of beer, and we went down to the basement, put a movie on it. His friend with the fake was the experienced drinker, so he got what's the math there? 10, 8, and 6. So he got 10 beers. My buddy was the medium drinker. He got the 8 beers, and I was the newbie. I got the 6 beers, Coors Light, might as well have been a six pack of water. But it was enough. And you know, I got the spins that night. You know, I lived next door, so they crashed there in the basement. I went home next door because, well, I got a bed there, and the whole world was spinning, and it was the most miserable feeling ever. I sat there up all night at the edge of my bed with the light on, and you know, I was sick. But one thing I could remember was that sense of relief. Even though I was terrified of the consequences of drinking, you know, I was afraid of getting in trouble again, people looking at me, you know, that kind of stuff, you know, and how miserable of an experience it really was, I couldn't wait to do it again. And basically from then on out, every chance I got to drink the way I wanted to drink, I did. And it was a lot of years of that, you know, so off to school. Again, dragged through school and dragged across the finish line. But once I got out and I was living on my own, there wasn't much in the way of any of that. You know, I had very few consequences. But, you know, the emotional, psychological, mental consequences, the physical consequences, they were all there. You know, I could barely get up in the morning to go to work. I was passing out on the floor every night. I was a nightly blackout drinker for over a decade. I couldn't deal with anything in life. And the worst part was, is that I had this feeling that I knew. It's like, I know I shouldn't feel this way, but I can't figure out why I do. I just couldn't figure out. It was the mental obsession. It was the insanity of just like, what is wrong with me? I don't know. So I'm going to numb it. And I would drink to blackout every night. And so after a long time, after I got it, this is actually an important part of the story. You know, a lot of things happened, but again, I want to get to the good stuff, which is God. But after I graduated college, I adopted a dog. I'd always wanted a dog. And, again, I was very sick, very drunk all the time, and I was not a good owner. But that dog, try not to, you know, didn't matter how badly I treated that dog, how angry I'd get when I come home, there'd be a mess or something torn up, you know, but that dog loved me through it. Nothing more he wanted in the world just for me to be home with him. And, you know, and so he basically got that wish when COVID happened. You know, COVID happened and, you know, where I work, we shut down completely. No one was in there for, you know, 4 months or so, figuring some stuff out. But that last year of drinking, you know, again, was sober 2021. So I had a year into COVID where I was drinking something fierce. I was determined not to come out of it. And one of the last things I'd been telling myself for a long time was that dog was the last reason I was getting up in the morning. You know, just getting up to feed him, take care of him, whatever. And then he got sick. And you know, that was that just jumping off point. I could not picture many more days, you know, and it was scary. And a lot of crazy things happened in my life right around that time. You know, that I can't think of any other, you know, way to express it than a miracle. But a good friend of mine at work, they had a sister who died of the disease. They couldn't take it either. Took a bottle of pills and ended it. And, you know, it was always the big joke or elephant in the room at work with my good work friends that Adam was the drinker. He's like, Adam, what'd you do last night? Well, I got drunk, you know. And so this friend, you know, we were talking late one night, like 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, just over Zoom. They were in Wisconsin with family, dealing with the fallout of that. And he said, you know, Adam, you know, the dog died and I was devastated all about that. Adam, are you an alcoholic? Yes. Like, do you want to get help? Yes. And, you know, I joked often about being an alcoholic. Actually, I joked, I can't be an alcoholic. I don't go to meetings. Hello. But it didn't matter that I knew I was an alcoholic for a long time. I didn't have any way to stop drinking. So, and so that friend got me into rehab. They made the calls. I gave them my insurance card, said, fine, whatever. I don't care. I'll go anywhere. I'm out of ideas. And I'm out of hope. I was out of hope. I was hopeless. Just had nothing. And walking into rehab, you know, it's still funny. I wish I could say this is like when I surrendered is when I went to rehab, but I did not. I did not surrender. I still had all these great schemes. It's like, well, so, you know, they call me up after she made the call and connected to them. You know, they call me up. It's like, all right, we're ready for you. You know, we got a room for you. It's like, whoa, 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 hold the horses, hold the horses. I got plans I need to set in place. You know, I need to talk to work. I need to make sure someone comes by and cuts my lawn. I need to be sure someone comes by and brings in the mail. You know, all these stupid plans of things that didn't matter. And you know, so that was real big clue to me as to why I, you know, hadn't surrendered it. And so I went into rehab at the end of March 2021. Again, my sobriety date is May 2021. And when I finally got into rehab, it was the biggest weight ever lifted off my shoulders. It felt like thousands of pounds just taken off my back. And it was an awesome experience for me. They gave me everything I needed to get out of there with a good foundation for sobriety, and I didn't take any of it. They told me to get straight to meetings when I got out, get a sponsor, go to 90 and 90, get involved in service and work the steps. And I said, yes, that's great for all of these other people, but I have to get back to work. And when I got back to the house, nobody had come by to cut the grass. It was like 2 feet high. I got to cut the grass. I got to get the mail. You know, I had all these plans and things that I had to do. When I was in rehab, I could have taken a lie detector test, said I was never drinking again, and I would have passed. And it took me 2 weeks. 2 weeks out of rehab of just going back to my own regular affairs, and I was drunk again. And you know, one of the many blessings when I was in there is I made a friend that was a guy who had some time before, had a slip, came back in, you know, was in an institution. And I called him sobbing after I got drunk. It was like 48 hours nonstop drinking. I could not stop. I was hanging out with friends in Charlottesville. We were having a good day, and all it took was the drive home from Charlottesville to Fredericksburg for me to go through all the stages of convincing myself, you know what? I think I could take a drink again. You know what? I think I deserve to take a drink again. I did so good keeping myself sober for 5 weeks. You know, it's like, I think I can handle this. You know what? I need a drink again. And I'll just go to the store and I'll get a little bottle and that'll be it. And I'll be okay. I walked out of that store with my usual haul of a couple handles. And once I took a hot top off, I couldn't stop drinking. I called that friend sobbing. Bernie, I don't know what happened. You know, I drank again. And, you know, I was probably looking for pity, and he just laughed in my face. He said, you know, he's just laughing hysterically. He said, of course you did. You're an alcoholic. What are you going to do? I'm going to go to a meeting to pick up a 24-hour chip. I said, that's right. Call me when you're there. And so that's when I went to my home group, which is Any Lengths in Fredericksburg, Virginia. I forgot to mention that. And Any Lengths was called that because when COVID started, every in-person meeting in Fredericksburg was shut down, especially all the evening ones were. And so this was the only in-person evening meeting, and it met every night at 7 o'clock at a park downtown Fredericksburg, where there was no restrictions on you know, us being able to get in person. And so I went to that meeting. This was the second time I went to that meeting. I did go there a couple days after I got out of rehab. It would have been my 30-day. It would have been the time to pick up my 30-day chip. And when they announced that I was ready to stand up, but someone else stood up to get theirs. And then all of a sudden, I just slinked back. I said, I don't want to pick up this chip. And, you know, in the next few days, I drove by that meeting, but I didn't go down to the park. I got so scared, I just kept driving. I wasn't ready to surrender. And again, you know, I wish I could say when I got back to that meeting and my sobriety date did start that I was surrendering at that point. But the only thing I was surrendering was, I know I can't take a drink. These people have it. Let me just go there and see what they have to say. And got to that meeting, picked up my 24-hour chip. Couldn't tell you a thing about what was that said at that meeting. I'm sure, again, I was sweating, shaking, probably crying some. I don't know. Too wrapped up in myself to notice anything else that anyone else was saying. But at the end of the meeting, a guy turned to me and just said, "How are you doing?" I said, "Oh, I'm fine." Big lie, big lie. But something hit me in the back of the head. Just like something hit me. He's like, "No, Adam, like say the truth." I was like, "No, I am not fine. I'm not fine. I'm not okay. I am freaking out, but I'm here." And I'm sure he just laughed and said, "Yeah, keep coming back." Something like that. Because that's what I would do to someone if they said the same thing to me. It's like, "Yeah, I know you're insane. I was there too. Keep coming back." You know? And I did. At the very least, that's what I could do. That's what I was willing to give up was my evening, you know, because when I was there, I was pretty sure I wasn't going to drink, and I didn't. So it was nice to see that proven. And you know, the fellowship and the unity kept me coming back. You know, just awesome people. And, you know, listening to what they had to say, I'd never heard my life described in someone else's life so well before. The insanity, the fear, the anxiety. And that's how I found my sponsor, was a guy who would talk about, you know, all those same things, just like being a child and being terrified of nothing. It's like, yes, that's the guy. You know, it's like, that's what I have, or that's what I have now, and that's what he says he had, and he doesn't have it anymore, so take me. And that came at 4 months. It took me 4 months to ask him to be my sponsor. You know, because for a long time coming in, I was giving this program half measures. I wasn't drinking. I was going to a lot of meetings. You know, every night I'd be at the park, and then on weekends, you know, once the meetings did start to open back up, we had 4 or 5 Saturday and Sunday. I was afraid to be by myself. That was the worst thing, you know. Like, I'm good in a chaotic situation where things are on fire, people are bleeding, and all that stuff. Like, I can just zen out and see the next thing to do and all that stuff. But when I'm alone by myself, that is when I go crazy, because the thoughts just start racing and I can't slow them down. I've been insomniac ever since I was a kid, when I was 4 or 5, you know. I just couldn't sleep because I just think about the day and how terrifying it was and how much more terrifying tomorrow was going to be. I couldn't sleep. I'd get a couple hours every night, just be exhausted all the time. I was always sleeping in class. You know, and so... got my sponsor and, you know, got involved in service. You know, one of my, being there within a week, Fredericksburg throws a big 4th of July picnic every year. Come on out. It's a lot of fun. Someone at the meeting there said they were doing committee meetings. And I was like, all right, I'll go to that. You know, my friend Bernie said it was important to get involved in service. I'm going to listen to him because I don't know what I'm doing. You know, and service has been so important for me, mostly because it got me meeting so many people. You know, I could tell you all about how it made me selfless and, you know, all that kind of stuff, but that's not, you know, it eventually happened, but it made me meet a lot of people, and it held me accountable, because I didn't like letting people down, because then I'd be in trouble, I'd have consequences, and I didn't like that. But you know, service met a lot of great people and had a lot of fun. But, you know, through all this, I was still, you know, my sponsor was a sponsor in name only. I'd call him, check in. We'd see each other at a meeting several days a week. But we hadn't started any steps. And I was 6 months sober when I had this episode. So many things all happened at once. Again, another miracle, you know. All the planets aligned just right for this thing to happen. And at 6 months sober, I just had this screaming fight with my mom. You know, this is something that would normally happen you know, throughout our lives. But I was like, I'm sober. Like, I thought this was supposed to stop happening. I hadn't taken a drink in 6 months. Like, why am I still the same jerk I was when I walked in? And I'd been to enough meetings, and I've been listening to the Joe and Charlie tapes a lot. And, you know, I just heard enough in the rooms that I knew leaving that fight, the first thing I had to do was pray. And I didn't really pray a whole lot. But from the Joe and Charlie tapes, you know, I heard them say, pray for the other person to get what you want. And that's what I said. I just God, give her the same peace, comfort, and serenity I want. And, you know, it's like all I can muster at the moment. And then I called my sponsor and said, I was just a raging jerk. You know, I didn't, somehow I didn't take her inventory on that phone call. I just said, I was a jerk and I don't know what to do. So, well, don't drink and I'll see you tonight. And when I hung up with him, almost immediately, a friend I'd made sent me a text and said, what are you up to today? Nothing. You know, I said, good. You know, come on over to the American Legion. We're going to set up for the Halloween dance. I said, fine. And lo and behold, you know, sometime later, I found out that all those things are exactly what it says on page 84. You know, when we're taking our on the spot inventory, and it says we continue to watch out for fear, resentment, dishonesty. You know, we ask God at once to remove it. We talk with someone about it immediately. We make amends if necessary. I made amends the next day, so I did get to that. But then we resolutely turn our thoughts to helping someone else. And all those things, boom, checked. And, you know, once I made amends with her and I did the thing that I didn't want to do, you know, the problem was removed. And at that same time, again, you know, doing my half measures, but me and my roommate was a guy I'd met in the rooms. We had started a book study at our house. Actually, no, I don't think he wasn't my roommate at the time. That would come later. He wanted to see if I was serious before he, you know, made that jump. And so we were reading the big book, just three of us in my living room. And we would just read a paragraph, talk about it, read a paragraph, talk about it. And so around this exact same time, we got to page 25, which is right before page 29. And there's a solution is my favorite chapter. So again, like delighted to hear that that was the idea behind the share. It was, you know, page 25, when the paragraph that starts, there is a solution that talks, you know, almost none of us like the self-searching, the confession of our shortcomings, the leveling of our pride that, you know, this process requires for successful consummation. At the end of that paragraph, it's got one of those first asterisks where it says, go to spiritual appendix number two for further. And so by whatever reason, we took a vote. And I think all three of us said, yeah, let's go read the appendix now rather than wait like 6 years until we got to it page by page. And, you know, wonderful reading. It put it into words in a way that I finally wasn't afraid, because when I got here, I was afraid of God. I was afraid of religion. I thought, you know, us meeting down at the river, I thought if I took step three, that you all were going to take me in that river and baptize me and, you know, sing some songs, and I wasn't afraid of that. But, you know, the spiritual experience just puts that idea in a different light, one that I could comprehend, one that I wasn't afraid of. And at the end, it said, you know, the only thing that keeps us from having the spiritual experience is this contempt prior to investigation. And I just blurted out, ah, crap. That's me. I told the guys then and there, it's like, that's me. It's like, I just don't want it, so I can't have it. And a friend, you know, the guy in that meeting, a guy with a lot of sobriety, you know, I'd always heard in the meetings this idea that step zero is this stuff's got to stop, usually a little more crude. This stuff's got to stop. But he pointed out to him, and I was pointed out to him, is that step zero is right there in how it works. And it's if you've decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. And I didn't know what you all had, so I couldn't know that I wanted it. And then when I read the spiritual experience, I got this better idea of what you all had. I finally made the decision I wanted it. And that was when I called my sponsor and said, let's do this. And I didn't think it was going to work for me. I thought I was special, you know, terminally unique. Don't know if anyone's ever felt that way. But I at least started it and I tried. And, you know, we worked through the 12 and 12. Excuse me. Worked through the 12 and 12 because, you know, big book's got a lot of big words, and I'm not very smart, even though I like to think I'm the most brilliant person in the room. And you know, we just worked through it week by week. And you know, I always love, I love the way 12 and 12 puts a lot of those inside steps, you know, especially like 4 through 9, you know, especially 6 and 7, you know, because what's one paragraph in the book is finally like spelled out, and it's like, all right, the book's just like, all right, you're ready to have God remove all these defects, and you ask him, and then go sit silently for an hour or something like that. It's like, I don't know, what does any of this mean? You know, it's like, how do I do that? But for me, 4 and 5 were huge. You know, I lost a lot of people that I loved very much while I was drinking. I'd go there and be in body, but I wasn't there in spirit and in mind. You know, I was just basically using it as an excuse to be miserable and drink. A lot of these people, you know, some of my closest friends for the longest time, since I was a kid, and my father, one of them, I actually had resentments against these people because they died. What a sick and selfish thing, right? You know, but I had to put it on paper, and I had to tell my sponsor about it. We did our we I did my fifth step with him in the lobby of the Courtyard Marriott in downtown Fredericksburg. So plenty of people there, just sobbing my eyes out. Yeah, just like sobbing, crying. It took us two different, like 3 hour sessions to get through it, because, you know, like the whole 90% of the inventory took about, you know, like one session. And then the five people, basically my close family members, that took a whole other session. But the promises that the book says in step five, you know, I do love, we read the 9-step promises, but each step has their promises in the book. The step five ones came true for me. You know, it was that first time that I felt something. Because even though what I had just gone through wasn't pleasant, it was uncomfortable, scary, devastating. After it was done, I felt something. That it was that same sense of relief when I took that first drink way back when. That's what it was. That's the best way I could describe it. It was for the first time in a long time, those racing thoughts, that insanity, that obsession, just quieted even for the briefest moment. And I wanted more because I have the disease of more. And you know, so that was kind of the start. That was really the start, you know, and that was almost a year into my sobriety. I'm not, you know, hear some people say, I don't recommend. Wait, it's like, I don't know. It takes what it takes. It took me 6 months to realize that I was insane. And as it says in chapter two, you know, the problem centers in my mind. And I had to come to the realization that if the problem centers in my mind, it's not going to be my mind that fixes the problem. Because I still thought I was going to think my way out of it. I was going to figure out some kind of solution. Like it was a math problem. Again, like I thought I was this brilliant person. I could solve these math problems on the chalkboard. Like if I walked into a room, I can't, I'm dumb. But I thought I could. Yeah. It's my ego, my pride. When I did my fourth step, I did not think I was a prideful person. I did not think I had vanity. I hated myself. How could I be selfish and self-centered if I hated myself? But we went through it. All those problems, all that self-pity. You know, the way Joe and Charlie describe it, and the book says it too, you know, literature says it. Self-pity is the worst form of selfishness and self-centeredness. And that's what I was raised with. And so I was, you know, the most selfish person I knew. And that was not a fun pill to swallow. But I say all that because, you know, I had to know where I was starting from. You know, if the book is this, you know, as it says, this means to find a power greater than myself, where I lack the power to solve my own, you know, solve my own problem. And I had to find this power. I didn't know where I was starting from to get there. So I like to think of it as it's like a treasure map, you know? And each person's treasure map is different because they're all starting from different places and their treasure might be in a different place. And so what my sponsor did is, you know, he just told me how he drew his map. And when he ran into the same obstacles I was running into, well, this is where I went. I turned left. Maybe you need to turn left, but we'll try it together. If you don't need to turn left, let's go right. And so it was a long time. You know, again, like I said, it was months after that incident with my mom where I came to recognize that that was, you know, God working in my life. Just by going to meetings, listening to the Joe and Charlie tapes, like doing all these things. And, you know, I got a group that I go to often called Rappahannock Speakers Group, and they read a reading before their speaker that they call the original AA preamble. I looked it up online. First, I've also seen it called the Delaware preamble or the Wilmington preamble, something like that. But it has this line that I love in it. And this line's also kind of in the book. But, you know, it says, you know, in order to and establish a habit of depending upon and relying upon and deferring all we do to our higher power, we have to first apply ourselves with some diligence. And so that's what those meetings were doing. That's what listening to Joe and Charlie on my drives were doing. That's what calling alcoholics and my sponsor was doing. It was building up this habit because I didn't know what to do. You know, again, when stuff's going crazy, I can find the next thing to do. But like after that fight with my mom, when I'm insane and running through it over and over in my head, I didn't know what to do. And that's where the runes of AA broke through. That's where I found my higher power talking to me, is through you all. And you know, like I said, the book also says this, you know, we alcoholics are undisciplined, so we had to let God discipline us in the way we just outlined. I needed discipline. I was, like I said, a terrible student, never did any work, lazy. So lazy. But at the very least, you know, I will say that those first 6 months not taking a drink let me be clear-headed enough to finally get to where I needed to be. You know, and it's been a real miraculous ride ever since. I love talking about this because, you know, this is one of those things. Again, I wanted nothing to do with religion when I got here. A friend of mine that I met at this Rappahannock Speakers Group, he goes to these things called the Matt Talbot Group. And they're these wonderful spiritual retreats. Met a lot of folks that are just great. And the first one I went to, you know, again, I thought I was going to, like, be ostracized because it isn't a Catholic thing. It is a Catholic thing. It's not an AA thing because it is associated with the religion, but they welcome everyone. And I'm there, and it's a wonderful speaker. You know, it's just this whole series of talks by the speaker. He's just this amazing speaker, identified everything with what he said. And you know, again, when I first found my higher power, and again, I said page 84 is so special to me. It's because the last line in that paragraph of talking about what we do, that checklist when resentments come up, the last line is love and tolerance is our of others is our code. And I said, if that's our code, that can be my higher power. Just whatever, love and tolerance, that will be my higher power. And so I'm at this retreat, and this speaker is, you know, he's a priest, decades of sobriety, decades in the church, and he closes this whole series of talks with, you know, posing a question. It's like, does anyone know what the definition of God is in the Bible? And you know, sorry, don't mean to bring out outside issues, but this was a big moment for me. He said, there's lots of descriptions of God. You know, God is almighty, God is all-knowing, God is omniscient. There's only one definition, and that's that God is love. And I thought, oh man, here I have this priest telling me that his God and my God are the same God, you know. And you know, it again just changed me, realizing how wrong I've been about everything. I was telling someone before the meeting, you know, the less I know, the better life gets. Because when I got here, I knew everything. I was going to solve my problem, and I was going to solve a lot of your problems too, because you guys were not doing any of this right. But you know, I was wrong. That event at 6 months proved I was wrong. A lot of other things since then have proved I was wrong. You know, the only thing I've really gotten right is being willing to not take a drink and listen to some suggestions. And you know, I try to not say no, because I was pig won't. I said no to everything. And another way of that chapter two describes the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is a program for living that works. And my way wasn't working. My way of life wasn't working. Back to there is a solution. It says we had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as I had been living it. Not drinking as I had been drinking it, life as I had been living it. Alcohol was my solution. Alcohol was the only thing that calmed my terrible way of living. I needed a new way to live. And Alcoholics Anonymous provided that. Just had to keep coming back, keep listening, keep an open mind, and at least be trying to try some of these things. When I got here, and when I was in rehab, some folks had said this idea that, you got to be willing. If they tell you to do a headstand in the corner for the whole meeting, do it. It's like, yeah, I'll do that. I'll do a headstand in the corner for the whole meeting. If they tell you to push a marble down the interstate with your nose, like, you go do it. It's like, yeah, I'll do that. I will do that if they ask me. And then when I got here, all my sponsor said was, well, pray. I said, no, I'm not going to do that. I was wrong. I was very, very wrong. I said some prayers, a lot of prayers on the way out here. Again, this is very fearful for me, but God gives me the courage to get through it, hopefully without making too big of a horse's ass out of myself. Sorry. I found that it's only in those moments where I really turn to and rely on my higher power and earnestly ask for some help that I get it. Because there's still so many days and so many times in each day where I think I've got it figured out. I've got this. I've got this. Like, I'm just going to work. How bad could this be? And by the time I get to work, I've been alone all day, or I'm alone the whole time in the car, and everything's bad. Everything's bad, I just ask God, just God help. God, thank you. Like, man, I keep my prayers to like preschool level manners. Just like, please and thank you. Please and thank you. Because I'm not smart enough to figure anything else out. Help them or bless them, help me, I'm just a real simpleton, but the nice thing about being a simpleton is it's a simple life. I just wake up each morning and I ask for help to get through the day sober and hopefully a little bit sane too. And when I go to bed at night, I thank him for that day. I try to recognize at most, everything I've said up here, nothing's an original thought. Not one thing I said has been an original thought. Everything's come from the rooms of AA or other spiritual literature or even non-spiritual literature. My friend who got me into rehab, not spiritual, but I had to be willing to listen to someone who had just gone through something so terrible and knew what was waiting for me if I had kept going on the way I was. So, I just try to keep that open mind and recognize that nothing I have in my life today is something that I did. It's just something I've kind of accepted. It's kind of been something that's been given to me, but I just had to be willing to walk in that direction. Me and my roommate love to talk about it. This idea that those first 6 months I was running away from alcohol. I was running away from that drink, and I thought that's what AA was. I thought you all would teach me how to run that marathon away from alcohol, long enough where I'd get those external things I wanted, and then I'd be cured because I'd be happy or something. But you taught me, no, it's not about running away from alcohol. It's about walking towards a solution. And there's sometimes I do run pretty fast towards that solution. Times I'm doing, really well, things are going great. Then there's other times where I'm kind of like, veering off to the side a little bit because I've got a good idea. I've got a good idea of what I should be doing right then. But luckily, because I keep coming back to the rooms, I keep working my steps with my sponsor. And I've got real close. I live with another alcoholic in recovery, so we talk all the time, about just how insane we are. And I need that to bring me back on course, on back on that walking course, just a nice, easy walk towards a solution every day. And I don't have to walk or run more than I can in any given day. I don't have to strain myself. I just have to stay on that beam. And life's really, really good when I do. Not because I've been all those external things I thought AA would get me. My life is still the same. If you look at my life from like my neighbor, say my neighbor's like looking at me through a telescope, you know, my life looks the same. Except for the amount of trips I took to the recycle bin. You know, my life looks the same, but everything up here and in here is vastly different. I'm able to put my head on my pillow at night and go to sleep. I'm able to talk to people when people were the scariest things in the universe before. I'm able to do this, you know? Gives me the willies. I try not to think about it too much, you know. I just try to remember, I picture myself in my underwear and then you're all right, you know. It's like, maybe it's the other way around. But, you know, life's good. Life was good before. I didn't have the ability to see it. I didn't have any way to appreciate it. Like that dog. You know, that dog kept me alive for a long time. When I have nothing else, and I treated him like crap, you know. And it took a spiritual experience to realize that that dog was that higher power of love in my whole life the whole time. I guess that's why dog is God backwards. But I don't think I can end on a better line than that. So that's where I'll stop. Thanks. Yeah.